Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 30th, 2025, and our friend John Helmer is back with us. Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much, Nima. Thank you.
When you look at the situation right now between the United States and Russia, and a lot of pressure from Donald Trump and his administration to put an end to the conflict as soon as possible. On the other hand, Russia doesn't see this as a quick sort of settlement. Why is it so too much difficult for Donald Trump to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine, to provide what Russia needs from the United States?
Well, the Trump administration is itself internally divided, and I might say it's normal in governments to have factional differences, is first point. Second point, so is the Russian government. I wouldn't say divided, but there's been a very serious factional debate over how to respond to the battlefield changes, how to respond to the European demands and to the difference between the European demands and the Trump demands. If you're asking me to talk about Trump, I have to say, I'm sorry, Ray McGovern can't be with us today. He's in Moscow having to work right now, so he couldn't join us. So I'll try to reflect first his point of view and then mine. It's very important, as Ray has said on this program and elsewhere, that Trump should be believed to be the peacemaker. Second, that there is, from Ray's point of view, a tactical imperative, a tactical opportunity for the U.S. administration to change the security architecture of Europe in Russia's favor. And Ray has a moral view, which I share, peace is a necessity, and avoiding an escalation towards nuclear war is vital. My interpretation of what Trump is doing is, as we explained last time, and there have been important developments, I think, corroborating that view now, that Trump is simply trying to avoid running two wars at the same time. He is trying to reduce the amount of U.S. direct engagement on the Ukrainian battlefield and oblige the Europeans not only to take over the financing and arming of the Ukraine to a large extent, and pay the United States to do that. He's also requiring the Ukraine to pay the United States to do that. But he's wanting to reorient his forces and his limited U.S. capacities towards war with China. We called this the sequencing strategy last time. What Ray's called Kellogg's cornflakes is a reference to retired Army General Keith Kellogg, who remains, despite our predictions that he would be sidelined and then replaced as a negotiator for the president. Kellogg remains and speaks very confidently still that he speaks for the president. Now, Kellogg has gone on air on Fox News, which is a White House outlet, to say the president does not accept the offer of a Victory Day, three-day ceasefire, which President Putin proposed on Monday. So to the extent that Trump, Vitkov, who was in Moscow last week, and Putin agreed on a sequence of moves, Kellogg has just rejected them in the name of the president. And if you'd like, we can read out what Kellogg has said. But my first answer to your question is, if Kellogg is saying President Putin's three-day ceasefire, Victory Day ceasefire, is absurd, and that was the word he used. He went on to say that Russia is not advancing and is not capable of advancing to take Kiev, something Russia has not said it wants to do and doesn't want to do, has not taken Odessa, which is something Russia has not said it wants to do, and can only move meters, not miles. Those are the words Kellogg used. We come back to them. Kellogg is stating a clear view among some of Trump's advisors. Okay, so part of the answer to your question is Trump can't achieve what he wants in a hurry because his own people differ strongly with what his line has been. Second, Trump himself changes his mind. So on the one hand, we saw a sequencing, if you like, in at the St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican during the Pope's funeral ceremonies, in which Trump orchestrated a photo opportunity of himself sitting on a chair with Vladimir Zelensky in the Basilica and having what seems to have been a very limited 15-minute maximum conversation in which Trump did all the listening and Zelensky did all the talking after the chair, which had been set down for President Macron to sit on or Prime Minister Starmer to sit on, had been removed. From the sequencing of that, it's clear, and I talked about it in the Dances with Bears and showed the exact sequence minute by minute. What Trump wanted to do was a photo opportunity to say he's made up with Zelensky, that the Oval Office performance is best forgotten, and that he is listening to Zelensky and is prepared to move with a Ukrainian version of the term sheet. That's the list of terms. Kellogg has said there were 22 points on the terms agreed in Europe with Zelensky, the Germans, the French, the British, and which Witkoff then took to the Kremlin last week. Trump was saying, I'm supporting Zelensky. He then went straight out to his airplane, and in the air, he began to be hostile again to President Putin. What then was a sequence was Trump says in photographs, I'm listening to Zelensky. Forget about me being divided from or angry with Zelensky. Then he's hostile to President Putin for firing on civilians, as he said. That isn't what happened, but that's what he said. He then intensified his threat in the airplane on the way back to the press, saying he's not sure that President Putin is serious about peace and he's got other things up his sleeve, by which he then went on to say additional arms, additional sanctions. So he increased the threat. Then on Sunday, so we're talking day by day sequence, the Trump administration sent Secretary of State Marco Rubio to go on television to say a number of things, which also increased the pressure of President Putin to meet the US points, the term sheet, and do so in a hurry. On Monday, President Putin replies. He replied with the proposal for a ceasefire, which we've anticipated for more than a month now, a third ceasefire for the Victory Day period, so May 8 to midnight, between May 10 and May 11. But it was clear from the language President Putin used that the root causes of the conflict have to be addressed. That's the underlying creep of NATO on all fronts, not simply Ukraine. And second, if the Ukrainians violate it, the Russian side will respond appropriately. So there was the sequence. And what's happened subsequently, just a couple of hours ago, is that President Trump has now said, and I'm looking at my paper so I get it right, it was in the New York Post, if I'm not mistaken, asked about his current mood, which is today, Wednesday, as distinct from Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Today, what Trump says is, I'm not necessarily on Zelensky's side, but on Ukraine's side, yes. I've had a hard time with Zelensky. You saw that over here when he was sitting right in that chair when he just couldn't get it. That's what Trump said. I'm sorry, it came out today, but it was in the Atlantic magazine interview in the Oval Office a couple of days ago. So let's put it this way in answer to your question. Trump changes his mind all the time. And I'm being polite to say he's got a mind. What he's got is in fact a series of slogans he repeats over and over again with a very clear plan to promote himself as the peacemaker. But he said, he also said, but on the telephone to the Atlantic last week, he made a remark about his problem in his first term. His second term, I rule the country, I rule the world. I rule the world. Now, that's a very clear statement, not exactly a surprise about Trump, but it diminishes the amount of hope that Ray McGovern has expressed on what he's capable of and what the opportunity is for Russia. So you've got underlying factional fighting in Washington to continue the war, much as the Europeans, particularly the French, the Germans, and the British, and the Poles have been saying, and making a swift deal that makes Trump appear to be the peacemaker replacing the Pope, something Rubio was instructed to say on Sunday. Trump replaces the Pope as a moral force ruling the world for peace. That's the line they want to convey. On the other hand, the Russian side has said, look, here's another ceasefire. Let's see if Mr. Trump can control the Ukrainians to the extent that they won't violate the ceasefire. Now, that was offered between now and then, today, right now as we talk, Wednesday afternoon. What's happened? The Ukrainians have done several things. First of all, they said, why should we wait to Victory Day? Let's have an immediate ceasefire now. President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said, we can't negotiate such a complex of arrangements. The battlefield, the security architecture for Russia, the security architecture for Europe and NATO on all fronts. We can't do that at the speed at which Trump wants. We can't do it in a hurry. And second, this is a bit unusual, Peskov has said, we should have direct negotiations with the Ukrainians, and therefore they should remove their legislated ban on direct negotiations with Russia. That's a new line, because the Russian line is, and it's the correct understanding of the situation, the war's going on as a US war against Russia, using the Ukrainian battlefield and Ukrainian soldiers as proxies, as the platform. So I hope it answers your question. The Russian side is negotiating with a side he doesn't trust, inviting Trump to prove he will prevent Ukrainian violations of the ceasefire, while Kellogg responds for the president and says, we're comfortable with the way the Ukrainians are on our 22-point term sheet. And it's absurd of the Russians to offer this, meaning the Russians will not and should not expect to hold all four of the Novorossiya Russian regions in the Donbas. So it's Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson. They will get less. So the terms are in flux. The factions on either side are those in favor of prosecuting the war against Russia, and those who want to take the opportunity to make peace are prevailing on their leaders, and the leaders, Trump on the one hand, Putin on the other, are responding ambiguously and in some ways contradictorily.
John, who's avoiding the direct talks between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin? Because as you mentioned, this sort of unbalanced behavior on the part of Donald Trump is somehow problematic, not only for Russia, for China, for Iran. They're trying to get something, to get an agreement with the United States. But is that translated in the way that Witkoff is behaving, is talking to Russian part? Or Witkoff is much more consistent with the way that they're trying to pursue a Ukrainian settlement?
The short answer is I don't know. A slightly longer answer was given by Foreign Minister Lavrov a few days ago in his lengthy 44-minute interview with CBS, in which he made it clear he's not going to be led into discussions of the particular points. So if, let's say, 22 points in a term sheet, a statement of intention for both sides to negotiate the particulars, 22 points. Okay, Lavrov hasn't said what exactly they are, except he said Crimea is not on the table for us. And the broader structure of agreement for Russia's long-term security has to be on the table for us, and so forth. So I think it's fruitless for us to speculate, because it changes hour by hour depending on which side is putting out which propaganda line. And in the last couple of hours, we've seen a new propaganda line from the Ukrainians. They've said, they've told the FT, the Financial Times in London, the Japanese-owned propaganda outlet, very hostile to Russia. The Ukrainians have said that they're sending their deputy prime minister to Washington to sign that so-called minerals agreement, but it may not be signed because they've hit a significant difference. The US wants the Ukraine to repay, Trump's words, Trump's concept, the $100 billion to $300 billion number. It counts to have been the value of US military assistance to the war so far. The Ukrainians have said we're taking that out, and that the US capital investment in mining rare earth and other minerals and energy in Ukraine, the US capital contribution should be counted forward, the future of US military aid, which means that the Ukrainians have gotten an undertaking there will be ongoing US military assistance to the Ukraine. That's really important. It's not noticed by the FT, but the Ukrainians have been led to believe by Trump he will go on supporting the Ukraine with military aid. But the Ukrainians say we'll count that future against what we will concede to be US right to dig minerals and mining energy out of the Ukraine. Now, that's a very, it's not just a little disagreement between the Ukrainians and the Americans. It's a big one because of what it reveals. First, US has promised to continue military aid, intelligence sharing, all the elements of the war against Russia. But they can't agree on how it will be offset by the payback mechanism Trump is using. Now, that's a big difference in the structure of the negotiations on the Ukrainian side, the Russian side, sees it and therefore said, well, we're thankful to Peskov today, that we're thankful for US mediation. That's a change of line. We're not dealing with a direct war maker, the US. We're dealing with a mediator. So Vitkov is the mediator, just as you said. And he's laying out 22 points here and listening to the Russian presentation of what it considers to be the basis of an agreement with the United States, which also includes relief from sanctions, the dropping of sanctions entirely, and the end of the US economic war against Russia. So Vitkov is presenting his line, the Russians their line, and the Ukrainians have popped in the last few hours and said, our line is a bit different. We have our own, Shmigal, the prime minister of Ukraine, said, we have our own red lines. Oh, yeah, right, Ukraine has its own red lines. Now, it can only say that when the Ukraine knows its red lines are being defended by France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, and implied that the US will back it up as the war continues. So it doesn't help for us to speculate on what terms Vitkov brought, what message he took back. All we can see is through the propaganda fog and the fog of war. By the way, in the last 24 hours, the Russian military bulletin indicates there's been a 10% increase in military operations moving westward along the line. So what we can see on the battlefield, what we can see of the officials talking for the record at each other is very significant on all dimensions of the negotiating problem. And that suggests what President Putin, what the Russian side have wanted to test. Can Trump deliver what's in his head? Can Trump put substance from what he says in his mouth? And can he coordinate the allies? That's the test. And as Ray has correctly said, there is an opportunity here for the Russian side to split the Europeans and the Americans on the term sheet. Well, I don't think that's exactly the case, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
Our allies, really so-called allies, when it comes to Ukraine, because you've mentioned the meeting between Donald Trump and Zelensky in Italy at Vatican, and you've mentioned that Emmanuel Macron or Starmer could have been part of that talk, which they were rejected. Whoever was that was rejected from being there. What did they want to do, in your opinion, that they were rejected? And why did Donald Trump do that, if he did that?
Well, I think that's easy. I think it's clear. And I've written it for those who of our audience who want to stop listening and read the small print, because the small print's always a bit more dramatic than we can make it in a podcast. What happened? They all wanted a photo opportunity in one of the most beautiful sites in the world, St. Peter's Basilica. And they wanted to do it in a funeral demonstration of a peacemaking type. They wanted the chairs. They wanted to sit on the chairs instead of standing up and hugging each other. Okay, that's all. Because after Trump had his 15-minute sit down with the two chairs, and some of the footage which I've linked to on the Dances with Bear shows you the priests taking away the chair. You can see it going away. It's amusing. You can see Macron holding Zelensky by around the shoulder. You can see Starmer coming up. Then you can see each of their propaganda agencies placing their man in the front of the camera. You know, you can see the tweeting of the White House staff removing the others, entirely removing the others, and just Trump, not his back, which is their photograph at the beginning, Trump on left side talking to Zelensky on right side, their man in the center of attention. That was a PR stunt. Starmer got the BBC to run the picture, which he's the center of the picture. The French media got their man and their picture the same. And then what happened is left out. Zelensky went to the British embassy in Rome and had a walk around the garden with Starmer, fully photographed by the British propaganda agencies for 30 minutes. Oh, wow. You know, double the Trump amount. Double the Trump amount. And Macron did the same. Zelensky then drives around to the French embassy and takes a walk in their spring garden with Macron. Another 30 minutes. What's this about? It's PR. Indeed, one could seriously ask whether the whole several hours was anything more than a PR stunt. And then one comes to the question, is the division between Europe and the United States, between Trump and the European leaders, quite as deep, quite as angry, quite as irreconcilable as it looks? And then there's the answer to that question, and I'm sorry Ray isn't here today, but maybe next week. The serious, serious Russian concern isn't the British army. It isn't the French, though the French have nuclear weapons, which have been proposed to be based in Germany. It's Germany that's the most serious rising security threat from a Russian point of view. And this isn't being mentioned in any of the PR. It's not a PR stunt. The acting Chancellor Merz wasn't visible in Rome. He's just appointed a new foreign minister, Johann Vaderfu, one of his longtime foreign aides, a former Bundeswehr soldier, and a very hardline hater of Russia. Now, from a Russian point of view, the most serious medium-term threat is that Trump will help finance and supply Germany's $50 billion or billion euro rearmament program, all oriented, as Vaderfu has already said, to fighting Russia. Now, on the next week, we will have the victory parade in Red Square. And then it will be followed by the parade of the Immortal Regiment. And this is what all Russians, including me, celebrate. Not just the display of force necessary to defeat the Germans. Not just that, but the sacrifice, the loss of lives of their Russian relatives and mine too, who were killed by the Germans. Now, Dmitry Medvedev, the former president, has clearly said and called Merz's plan and Merz's threats to fly Taurus long-range missiles into Russia something that Vaderfu, the new foreign minister, has explicitly threatened. Called Merz a Nazi. That means that Germany is seen to be in its rearmament program, which Trump intends to supply, Germany will again aim at destroying Russia. Now, that's a very new element. We have yet to see the Germans, Merz or Vaderfu, sit on the platform once they're political status and their ministerial status is confirmed. But it's very clear to Russian side, and that's what the Immortal Regiment is designed to show. all of us suffered from the Germans, and we won't allow it again.
John, when you look at Donald Trump and his administration, whenever he's the Speaker of White House, is it Donald Trump or Secretary of State Marco Rubio? Whenever they're talking about the conflict in Ukraine, they're mentioning if they don't reach an agreement, we're going to leave Ukraine, we're going to let it. But the way that they're talking about Ukraine, it seems that as though they're not part of the issue. It seems that there's something, the United States is an outsider coming to the conflict to mediate between Ukraine and Russia. We know the conflict is between the United States and Russia. It's not Ukraine, is just somehow Ukraine was used to defeat Russia. But is that, do you think when it comes to Russian and Russian mind, do they really believe what Donald Trump is talking about? Because Donald Trump was, he's bragging today, he's bragging about javelins and the equipment, the arms he sent to Ukraine. He's so much proud of those sanctions on Russia. Mm-hmm. And he behaves somehow that I am the good guy and I'm trying to do something. And how is that going to be perceived by Russians, in your opinion?
Well, it's a good question, Nima. And on the one hand, we can talk about the political leadership. The political leadership in Russia is a multipolar political situation. It's not a Putin dictatorship. Although it's easier for Western propaganda to castigate Russia as a one-man state, likening Putin to Stalin. It's not. At the level or around the president, it's very clear, I think, been very clear since 2014, that some factions have learned slowly. Some factions said, we told you so, we wanted to do this, we understood the threat of the US and the Europeans and of NATO in Ukraine back then. At the level of the political leadership, there's on the one hand, in principle, and this is the opportunity Ray McGovern regards as hopeful, to reach an accommodation with the president of the United States, who's talking to us for the first time in several years. An opportunity, something positive. Talks proceed, as you just said, Stephen Witkoff was in Moscow for the fourth time, if I'm not mistaken, last week. So the opportunity is there. Second, the military general side and the intelligence side urge Putin to act in such a way as to test what Trump really means, which is to take your question and turn it into military observation and political intelligence and the like. Now, anticipating your question, what I've done is, in the Dances with Bears that was posted this morning, published this morning, I've tried to ask your question of the Russian people. And in fact, the Levada Center, a relatively independent national pollster based in Moscow, has asked these questions. And the answers I've put up in Dances with Bears are quickly so that people can go look at the charts and look at the text. But Russian people, it's very clear, the polls show it. On the one hand, very solidly support the president and the army. And that's reinforced by battlefield success, by the defeat of the Ukrainians in Kursk and the advance westward. On the other hand, there's a strong public support for negotiations. The, let's call it hawk, the hawkish Russian opinion is estimated by Levada to be somewhere between 5% and 15% of the national adult population. Only 5 to 15%, and they want to go all the way, in other words, to the capitulation of the Ukraine, to make sure that the Ukraine can't be a platform for anti-Russian attack, terrorism, assaults on the border and invasion and the like in the years to come. Roughly speaking, the Dove faction or the Dove population who want negotiations now on basically on US terms is roughly the same size, between 5% and 15%. And these positions are correlated, are associated with developments on the battlefield and support for President Putin domestically. The key thing to understand about Russian public opinion is how different it is from US public opinion. On the one hand, right now, Russians feel good. Public opinion is that the significant majority of Russians think the country's running in the right direction, that there's a very high level and stable level of support for the president, the prime minister, for the government, and so on. Now, contrast what these Russians think with the polls on the US side. There's a very interesting poll, which I've published a partial table, that was the data were gathered over the weekend by the Washington Post, Ipsos, and I've forgotten, ABC Television, produced a poll which asked people, Americans, enough sample enough so that the crosstabs can be examined. I'll come to them in a minute. Is President Trump too friendly to Russia, or not friendly enough, or is his policy towards Russia, the peace negotiation, more or less right? Now, the surprising thing is that there's a near majority of Americans across all party, age, region, race, and ethnicity that thinks Trump is too friendly with Russia. Too friendly. And that's not just the Republican base that President Trump appeals to every day through the tweets. It's across the board. It's particularly strong, oddly enough, when you look at the crosstabs in this poll. The tables are on the Dances with Bears this morning. Among Black Protestants I've suddenly forgotten the other group, but the important finding in this poll is that public opinion in the United States, Americans are hostile to Russia more than Trump appears to be saying. And the same Americans are increasingly hostile to Trump for his performance on the economy and worried about their own future. And the majority of Americans think the country's running in a negative direction. So the polls in the United States are going in the reverse direction for Trump. And the same poll that said the same public opinion that's increasingly disapproving of Trump, never mind what he says in tweets, that opinion is hostile to Russia. On the Russian public opinion side, we're positive about the future for Russia. A small minority wants to go to capitulation, military advance. A small minority wants peace on US terms, and the middle group are willing to have negotiations and test the Americans. But Russian public opinion is hostile to the Americans. And that's very interesting to see in the Levada poll. There's been, in the last 5 years, because of the war, or I should say because of the two wars, a complete switch in Russian public opinion. Russians thought 10 years ago that the Americans were their friends, were allies, and that's been a sentiment encouraged by US propaganda and to some extent by the presence of American brands, American TV, American films, American culture, and politicians who support the American line, and the business interests of Russia, which support business with the Americans. The positive attitude to Americans has switched, and because of the war, Russians are now persuaded the Americans are the enemy. And what used to be relatively hostile towards China and the Chinese has switched. The Chinese are our friends. The Chinese are our allies in this war. We like them more. So you can see the lines of public support. The Americans gone down, the Chinese gone up. Now, I'm trying to paint this picture of the two mental universes, the American, which is much more hostile to Trump's opportunistic approach to the Russians than Trump himself seems to be, and the Russian approach, which is much more hostile to the Americans than Putin wishes to be. So now you've got politicians who count votes. Putin has got no re-election coming in the foreseeable future, but he's got to deal with the future. He can't disregard this level of public opinion, nor can he disregard those members, those factions that say the Americans can't be trusted, which is a national sentiment now. On the other hand, you've got business interests who say, let's take the opportunity, led by Kirill Dmitriev, the US-educated counterpart for Stephen Witkoff. Dmitriev is saying all sorts of opportunities are here. Let's take them. Let's negotiate them as quick as we can. So you've got two blocks of public hostility towards each other. You've got politicians responsive to that who don't trust the other side. You've got an ongoing war which expanded in casualty terms by 10% over the last 24 hours on each of the five fronts facing west, facing the Dnieper River and Kiev. So you've got a combination there that isn't discussed in public, but locks the politicians into trying to satisfy all sides. And what can you do with forces like this? Well, the best you can do is to make sure your PR looks terrific. Make sure that you look to be in control, or as Trump exaggerates, I rule the world, and I rule the world from the Vatican. I'm almost the Pope. On the other hand, President Putin has to say, I'm offering to domestic public opinion. His ceasefire was offered to domestic public opinion as well as to Trump and as well as to the Ukrainian side. I will fight if they don't honor the ceasefire. That's everyone in Russia agrees that should be the case. It's not a surrender. It's not that kind of a truce. And second, the root causes of the conflict must be addressed. Now, there's fundamental Russian public opinion behind that. There's the foreign ministry that set out the solution for the root causes was the agreement, the draft agreements of December 17, 2021, and Peskov mentioned them again today. Root cause must be addressed. We are not going to sacrifice the casualties we've suffered, say the Russian people, for a short-term benefit for our businessmen. The Immortal Regiment will march on Thursday afternoon to signal we have lost these people. Our family was murdered by the Germans, by the fascists. We are not going to sacrifice their memory and ourselves for a repeat. So you've got, and this is the US side, public opinion and political opinion, is so hostile to the Russians that Ray's quite right, and I'm sorry he's not here to say it. There's an opportunity when a president like Trump does something that's beyond public opinion support.
John, here is the picture that you've sent me. I'm going to share it with our audience. What do you want to say about this picture?
Well, what we've been talking about so far is the extent to which President Trump's mind is changeable. What I've tried to do here is show you a chart of how money and money from the constituencies, friends, and family of President Trump, how money flows that towards Trump, towards the government agencies, in such a way as to produce the ideas that turn into the executive orders, the negotiating positions that we've been discussing. So at the bottom of the chart, you see these two significant U.S. oligarchs, Elon Musk on the left, Peter Thiel on the right. Now, they have placed in positions throughout the administration and in the middle structure a level of influence reflecting what they want, the money payoff for their support. So you have think tanks, you have social clubs, and you have investment funds in the middle line. This is only an example, a snapshot of part of a very complex process involving thousands of people and billions of dollars. We talked about the think tank the last time. The one I've mentioned there in the small print is the Marathon Initiative. The Marathon Initiative is invented by one Wes Mitchell, Trump first term State Department official, who's devised and written papers setting out the sequencing of war. First, let's take a breather in Europe, get the Europeans to fight the Russians while we refocus our war on China. You have a social club. The social club that I've mentioned there is called the Executive Board. I won't overstrain our audience's mind to indicate all the names, but the Executive Board has premises in Washington, D.C., where people pay $250,000 or $500,000 for admission so they can rub shoulders with the two Trump sons, Donald Jr. and Eric, and discuss business. And there are several names of the founders of this club who have particular interests in crypto financing, for example. And then to the left of them are investment funds created by all sorts of individuals. The 1789 Capital Group employs Trump sons. And what do these three groups do? They attract money from everyone wanting to lobby the administration for their private money interest. Think tanks, social clubs, investment funds. Investment funds, for example, can speculate on inside knowledge of what Trump's next executive order will do to the stock market, will do for the benefit of some companies, but not others. So you have short selling on the negative side and cheap buying of shares for resale later as companies associated with executive orders or Trump family take off. And gradually the press in Washington is beginning to show the level of conflict of interest, the level of inside dealing, money making, which results from President Trump's executive orders. Now, where do executive orders come from in the United States government? They are drafted by the White House staff. We're looking at the on the second level at the top of the chart, the WH, White House staff, the National Security Council, the NSC. What have I got there? I can hardly see.
Yeah.
DOD, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, the State Department. We know that, to name them, the NSC is run by Michael Waltz, the Defense Department by Peter Hegseth, the Commerce Department by a much closer friend, a business friend, an investor, Howard Lutnick, whose family is deeply involved in investment funds, which his sister, his children run, and where they also interact at the club level and the investment fund level below. The Treasury, Scott Bessent, and then we have Stephen Witkoff on the right, who's running a kind of individual operation, and they interact directly with Trump, directly. They move paper, and those papers can turn into tweets, they can turn into executive orders, they can turn into legislation. Now, in the Dances with the Reds I've just published, it's very clear that in the celebration of the 100 days, a lot of research has gone in and a lot of media reporting has come out, including Trump celebration tweets, to show that President Trump is running the government by dictation, by executive order. Executive orders, he's produced 142 in 100 days. This is an unprecedented number compared to every president preceding. And I've shown you the chart of what these are about in topic. A large number of them have foreign affairs topics. Second, much bigger than any presidents in Franklin Roosevelt in the Depression era. And then there's a, you can look at every president back to George Washington. Executive orders are the orders that a president can sign and are temporary because they can be easily reversed three ways: the next president, the same president himself, by the Congress legislating against or to block it or refuse it, a particular order or a series of orders, and by the courts. And the courts now have the largest number of challenges to Trump's executive order government in history. And there's a table to show how extraordinary the level of challenge is, and I've provided access to the table so everyone who wants to look this up can read each case, when it was filed, who it was filed, what the issues are. The attempt to legislate, which is much more difficult to achieve in a short time and much more difficult to overthrow, the legislation package that Trump and his advisors and officials prepared during the transition period has resulted in five new laws. This is very low by comparison. He thinks, his calculation is, I will do it fast, something you emphasized before. I will do it my way. And I'll do it because I rule the country, I rule the world, and this is the way to do it. But underneath this, and that's in the piece too, is an attempt first to satisfy that table of groups, lobby groups, and their money interests. It should pay off, and it should pay off in billions, and it should pay off quickly. Issuing government by executive order allows smart investment funds to take money which would otherwise be considered bribes, launder the money into influence, and turn the money into profit by trading your advanced knowledge of what Trump's about to do and what impact that will have on this, on the equity markets, the stock markets. That's how the system's running. Okay, and it's running in domestic terms for multi-billion-dollar payoffs to those people and those boxes. But there's a very serious, and I'm sorry Ray's not here to discuss it, serious concern that all Americans should have. And that is government by executive order is being proposed to the US Supreme Court for ultimate approval by the Trump lawyers since mid-February. They've essentially applied the cases identified, the people can, the audience can read the text. What Trump is saying is, I rule the country under Article 2 of the Constitution. I can dictate what goes on. Article 2 provides unlimited unitary executive power. That's what he's saying, and he's asking the Supreme Court, a mere majority of whom he appointed to their seats. And if any of the Democratic appointees have a car accident, fall off their chairs and retire, you can be sure Trump will pack the court even more strongly. What Trump is saying is government by executive order is presidential government without the need to have congressional approval. And in military terms, that means make war without congressional vote. That's his constitutional position. And it's a unique one. It's threatening a constitutional coup d'etat in the United States. And all Americans need to understand the legal issues at stake here are profound. Second, if Trump doesn't get his way with some of his, as he thinks of them, popular moves, he thinks he has the unitary executive power, unrestricted executive power to call in force. That means troops, police, to repress, cancel, stop, tear gas or whatever, jail, whatever his opponents are trying to say. So that's a power in the Insurrection Act, and people should read it to understand how far the president is going in running a one-man, I rule the country, I rule the world program. But we also have to understand from that chart that it appeals to many people, his supporters, through that box system, through those arrow flows. It appeals to them because they are making billions of dollars profit. So you have a huge money-making system, essentially unregulated, unopposed yet by Congress, opposed by courts in which Trump is reacting by having one or two judges arrested as examples to the rest. You have a very unstable situation legally, and you have a huge money-making situation, which is illegal, is in intent. It's what the racketeering statute in the United States used to call a racketeer-influenced organization. That's what that chart shows. It is by itself and its flows a RICO statute violation, a racket.
John, I wanted to ask other questions, but we're running out of time right now, and they're approaching 1 hour. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you very much.